It's time for America in the Balance. Brought to you by Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. And now your co-hosts, Ken Sellers and Amanda Teagarden.
And welcome, freedom-loving Oklahomans, to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Amanda Teagarden, in studio with James Parsons. And I just listening to that introductory music, and I'm looking at our producer, and it's like, we're going to have to re-record that.
Yeah, because I'm getting kind of tired of trying to fill Ken Sellers' shoes. I'm not doing a very good job.
Well, those are big shoes to fill, James. And here we are with our second broadcast of 2011. And James, you are the new co-host for America in the Balance. And how are you liking it so far?
Oh, it's great. I love it because my first time was with my good friend, former Senator Randy Brogdon, and this time it's going to be with another great patriot, and that is with Representative Charles Key. So I'm very excited.
Well, I am too. And as James mentioned, our guest today is Representative Charles Key, who is a state representative in the state of Oklahoma. And I'm just now looking up his, he's House District 90 in the state of Oklahoma. And regardless of where you're listening, because this is internet radio, we are broadcasting from Oklahoma. And we would like to direct your attention to our website, which is ok-safe.com. That's Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise, OKS-SAFE.com. And lots of good information there. And what we're going to be talking about today with Representative Charles Key is a very important rule change that has an interesting history behind it. When the legislature opens up, they adopt rules for the conducting of business, how the legislative process is going to be handled within the chambers. And there's a rule that needs to be changed, and Representative Charles Key is proposing a change to that rule to make for better government in the state of Oklahoma, and to make sure that all bills get a hearing. We're also going to be touching on the subject of nullification, and Charles is probably one of the country's experts on the subject of nullification and the importance of it, what that is, and why people should be aware of it. And the third thing we're going to be talking about, if we can get to that in this packed hour, would be the importance of participating in your local precinct elections. And without further ado, we'd like to introduce our guest, Representative Charles Key. Charles, are you there?
I'm here. Glad to be with you.
Well, we're glad to have you back. You've been our guest before. This will be first time with James Parsons, who also has a website and blog site. James, what's your blog site?
It's called Parsons' Opinion on Politics, the online poop.com.
Poop, P-O-O-P, Parsons' Opinion on Politics.
Oh, yes.
All right. That's very clever. All right. Representative Charles Key, explain for our listeners, please. The Oklahoma legislature begins on February 7th, and what is this rule that you are proposing that the legislature, the House, adopt in 2011?
Well, actually, I'm going to propose, and I've done this in the past, I'm going to propose that the House, because I can't propose that the Senate do anything with their rules. The proposal is going to be that we adopt a rule that says that any and every duly elected House member has the right to have his bill heard in a committee and receive a recorded vote on it, if he simply submits a written request to the committee chairman. And likewise, if a bill passes out of a committee and the legislator wants the bill heard on the House floor, if he just simply requested in writing, then that bill must be heard. Now, a lot of people might think that's kind of odd that you'd have to have a rule guarantee that. But actually, we have no rules that address this issue. But we have a practice. We have an unwritten rule that has allowed the speaker and any of the people that he chooses to be committee chairman or other what we call leadership positions to have this life and death power over any and every bill that's filed in the legislature. So here's the way I describe this to really get to the essence of the issue. People all over this state go every 2 years, they elect members to the House of Representatives. There's actually 101 members, and each district has about 35,000 people in it. So 35,000 people in 101 districts elect their representative. The representative goes, and all representatives go to the state capitol to represent those people. But then when they go up there to represent those people, they may submit legislation that may not even get a hearing. And the problem with that is that it's not saying no to an individual representative or maybe one individual bill or two or three, but you have someone from some other area of the state that might be a committee chairman, might be a speaker or a floor leader, that is saying to all those 35,000 people that they don't have a voice in their government. And the problem with that is it attacks and it destroys the very foundation of our government, of our system of government, and that is representative government, often referred to as democracy. And that's wrong. It's wrong, and it's a big problem, and it's one of the, if not maybe the biggest reason that we have in our state and our country today, the problem with the fiscal problems that we have and many others, is that what ends up happening is legislation that ends up getting heard is legislation that special interest or others want heard, and other very important reform legislation or legislation that the general public really wants to be heard and passed doesn't get heard at all. And I'll mention one other thing. One example is reform legislation when it comes to ad valorem taxes. We have in the state of Oklahoma this issue or problem where people's property taxes go up or can go up 5% every year. And that's been a very major issue for the last several years. A number of legislators have written legislation to fix that problem or address it in one way or another, reduce the 5% increase every year or eliminate it altogether, or set up a situation where the people in each county or the state would then vote and decide if they want their property taxes increased. We have just a handful or less of legislators who have kept that legislation from even getting a hearing to pass this important reform legislation on ad valorem taxes. And about 80% of the people in this state want it to be heard.
It's an interesting, a lot of things come to mind while we're listening to this, is that one is that it is clear that most people do not have an understanding or a clear understanding that this is a representative republic. And as you said, the 35,000 people that live in that particular House district are expecting representation in their state legislature. And when the will of the people is blocked because of a special interest or by one person saying you shall not have that bill heard, you have in effect cut out representation for, as you said, an entire block of people. And are you finding that is, was it always that way, or was that rule, this particular rule was adopted, when was this adopted?
Well, I haven't been able to look at all the history of Oklahoma, the legislature, to find out, you know, what the history tells us about that, but first, it's important to understand that there is not a rule that says that certain legislative leaders, again, as we refer to them, have that right or power to do that.
So it's been become a practice, though?
It's been a practice. It's not a right or a process or a procedure. I mean, the real assumption is that we elect a legislature and then they take on the business of the state, and that means that they openly discuss all of the issues that are brought forward. But what's happened over time is those that get the power in the legislature, in both the House and the Senate, they have a lot of power at their disposal. They choose the membership of every single committee, who's going to be on the committees. They choose who the committee chairman and vice chairman are. They make all kinds of other decisions. And as time has gone by, those groups of people, as they develop, in other words, we elect a speaker, for example, and then we allow him, because we don't take action to do it a different way, and I'll say something else about this in a minute, we don't choose to do it a different way, that speaker then chooses all the committee chairmen and the members of that committee. Well, those people become beholden to him, and all of them together as a group, they all share in the power together. So it's incumbent upon them, or to their advantage in some ways, to stick together and run the legislature and make the decisions together as a group.
Right. It just seems like that what you're talking about, instead of being ruled by 101 representatives, it ends up being ruled by maybe 4, 5, or 6 that are in control and have the powers. Would that be a correct assumption?
That's exactly what is going on. It's a handful of people at the most, and it's the good old boy system. It's been referred to for many, many years and decades. It's just the good old boy system. A few people make decisions behind closed doors.
Now, Representative Key, now, has there ever been... I guess I have two questions. One is, what is the argument against your rules that you often hear? And then second question, have you seen where other states have adopted your rules and how those apply? Those are my two questions for you.
Well, the second question first, I would say that there are some states that either prohibit this, or they specifically state that if two members, for example, in Nebraska, if two members want a bill heard, they request it and it must be heard, and it's a public hearing. All committee meetings are public hearings, but that's the way they handle it in Nebraska. I understand that some other states have variations on that rule, that if a bill is filed, then it will be heard in a committee. And that's the way it should be. Some action should be taken on the bill, as opposed to one person saying, no, we'll not even see the light of day. But the arguments against this typically are variations of this argument, that, well, we can't let members hear the bills, because then we'd have to hear all the bills, and we just simply don't have time to hear all the bills. And that's a real bogus argument, because we certainly do have the time to hear all the bills. Another thing that some people don't know, but many do, is this legislature is one of the highest paid legislatures in the country, $38,600. We meet Monday through Thursday, actually a half a day on Monday, all day Tuesday and Wednesday, and a half a day on Thursday. Now, as the legislature progresses, we may meet all day Monday and all day Thursday, but we never meet on Friday, except once in a while, at the very end of session, we might. The legislature also sets its own timelines. For example, the first 3 or 4 weeks of the session is a specific time period in which all the bills filed in the House, that are our House bills, must be passed out of the House committee, those that get hearings, and anything that doesn't survive that first time period does not have the ability to have to be heard again in that particular year. Well, those are just arbitrary timelines that we set. You'll also see committee meetings last from 30 minutes to maybe an hour and a half. And we could meet longer times to hear bills if we needed to. But frankly, none of those are the reason why bills can't be heard, or that if we or cause a time problem. The fact is, most all bills could be heard if that were the case, if we were going to make a rule to hear all bills, and that this rule is not proposing that.
How many bills?
But we could do that.
You could do that. Now, this brings up an interesting thing. How did they get so jam-packed with bills? And the rule is, or the guideline is, that each House member, 101, can each introduce 8 pieces of legislation. That's 801 bills right off the bat, plus all the appropriation bills. So it is a mammoth amount of bills to consider. And my position on this, and I think you and I have spoken about this before, there is no way on God's green earth that we need all these laws. So why not pull back from 8 bills to just a few, unless the majority of them are repealers?
Well, that rule actually states this. Give you a little history on that.
I think we just lost Charles. Let's see if we can get our producer to contact Charles again. So we're going to ask our listeners to hold on, and we're going to call him back. So anyway, this brings up this law, this idea here, James, while we're waiting for Charles to come back, is that, you know, God started with 10 commandments for the entire population of the world.
Right. And very simple, right?
Very simple, 10 commandments. And that was how you are to regulate your life. And then,
there's also another argument that I read yesterday in the Tulsa World. And there's a state senator, there's two state senators that are even looking at possibly...
Okay, I'm back.
That's all right.
Just a second, Charles.
In the state senate, there's legislation that's being looked at of possibly moving to possibly every other odd year for them to get into session. That could be just a different idea. But again, I don't see a reason why we need 808 rules or laws
every single year. All right, we've got Charles back on the line, and that's kind of where we left off, and you were going to explain or give us some background on that. Did we lose him again? All right, we're going to hear, you'll hear the phone ringing because we're going to have to call him again. Our producer calls them on Skype. He's on his cell phone, so I think we're experiencing a little phone problem with Representative Key. Oh, there's the ringing, so we're going to wait and see if he answers, and we'll try this again.
I'm back again.
All right, there you are, Charles. Okay, we were just talking about each representative allowed to introduce one bill apiece, eight bills apiece for a total of 808 possibly at the beginning, and you were going to give a little more background on that.
Yeah, the fact is the rule doesn't say you can only file eight bills. Each says that you have to choose what are your top eight bills as your priorities. So you can actually file more than that, but you know, the rule is saying that you have to designate your first eight or your top eight as your top priority bills. And one of the reasons that was put in place was to try to get a handle on the number of bills that are heard, but it was also somewhat in response to criticisms of this heavy-handedness that we have of committee chairmen and other leaders to not hear bills. And it implied that members could say, well, here's my top eight, and these are the bills I really want heard. And then somehow you'd get to hear those bills. Fact is, they don't honor that priority of eight bills anyway. But let me say this about the number of bills. I'm a citizen legislator, and I look at it, and I don't like all the laws that continually get passed either. In my opinion, the focus really needs to be on freedom and openness, not on restricting the number of bills, because I think it will police itself to a large degree if we have openness and transparency and freedom, because a lot of the things that go on in the legislature are done because legislators want to give the appearance of doing something, maybe that a constituent asked them to do, a group of constituents or others, or they want to be able to put it on a brochure or something like that. There is a certain amount of that goes on, and there's not an intent to carry through with a piece of legislation. It's really to be able to say, I filed bill number such and such to do X, Y, I, and Z, and sometimes it's parenthetically said, and that committee chairman wouldn't hear it, but I filed it. And those kinds of situations and some others would be eliminated if members didn't have that excuse anymore to blame what goes on in the legislature on someone else that allegedly wouldn't hear their bill. The other thing that would self-police this is that when you have members that file a lot of bills and they're wanting a large number of their bills heard all the time, you're going to have other members that are going to not like that. They're going to react against that, and it will self-police itself. And one more thing, the rule that I'm proposing doesn't guarantee or cause all bills to be heard. It only prohibits this practice of not hearing bills when someone doesn't like it. And that's what really has to be stopped. It's not that, oh, we've got to hear all the bills that are filed. That's not the point. The point is we must stop a few people controlling and running what goes on in the legislature and stopping important reform legislation. And the way they do that is they use this power of the good old boy system, and they just simply allow these committee chairmen to wield that power and not hear certain bills. That's what must be stopped, because, again, What they're doing is they're saying no to citizens. They're saying no to representative government.
Well, Representative
they're
Key,
saying no representation.
How do you propose you to get that rule changed? I mean, you're fighting against the good old boy system, and of course they're going to reject such a rule. What are you doing, or how can you assure us a rule change like that to actually occur?
Well, nobody can assure anything to pass in the legislature.
Right.
But what will happen is I will offer the amendment when the rules are taken up on the first day of session on February 7th. And, you know, there's some times in the past when I was in the legislature when the Democrats were in the majority. And they there was one year that they had a good time with this issue. They said to me privately, they said, well, we thought it would be funny to hear the bill. It's going to make us hear the bills. And we all had a good laugh with that. So that what they could do this year is they could choose not to hear it. Now, I've been told they're not going to conduct the business that day when we take up rules in that way. They're going to allow a free, kind of a free reign and openness of all members to offer amendments that they want to offer. We'll see if that happens, and I trust that it will. If they do, then it's going to be up to each and every member to take a stand and vote which side of this issue they're on. Are they for allowing their constituents to be heard through them, or are they going to allow people to run the legislature and the House itself? I hope that they choose to vote not only in their constituents' interest, but their interest as representatives of the people, that when they come up there and they file legislation that it's either requested by the constituents or they think it's very important, that it at least deserves a hearing and a vote.
On that issue of a hearing and a vote, will this be part of being broadcast, or if people are actually there in the chambers, in the balcony, listening to this, is this going to be a recorded vote, or this discussion on it, so will be open and available to the public to hear how their legislator, whether they debated against this rule, proposed rule, or advocated for it? Will that be available to the public?
Well, I'll be making the motion, and I'm sure others will too, that these votes that are cast, again, assuming that they actually take place, will be recorded votes so that there'll be a public record of it. And I hope that we have openness to the extent that not only will an issue be brought up, but it will be discussed with question and answers and debated so that, again, it can be openly discussed, the merits of it. And then there'll be actual debate. As you know, Amanda, that a lot of times they'll use some of these some of the rules that allow a bill to be not debated by moving previous question or forwarding the bill to another point in which there's actually not debate, but just it goes straight to a vote.
To avoid being on record on a particular position on this issue.
Yeah.
That
won't be a good sign if we see that happen. It really won't be a good sign. I've got high hopes for this this legislature, and particularly the House Speaker and others. But, you know, the proof's in the pudding. Time will tell, and we're getting ready to find out how this legislature is actually going to be conducted.
I think the next 2 years are going to be very interesting, and it's going to be we're going to pay more attention, I think, than we ever have before.
Hey, Representative Keyes, as far as the rules are set today and how they've been operated in the past, what kind of personal, what have you gone through personally as far as not having your bills heard, or what has happened to you personally through the current rules?
Well, you know, I've carried quite a number of, and really kind of started the movement here in Oklahoma, and maybe even nationally to a large degree, the 10th Amendment movement and the state sovereignty movement. And I've had some state sovereignty bills that they refused to hear in the last 2 years. Matter of fact, the 10th Amendment resolution that ended up being written about and then spreading all over the country in 2008 was almost not heard on the House floor because of the current at that time, the leader at that time, the floor leader, I should say, really did try to not let it be heard on the House floor. And it was only heard because I really pushed the issue pretty hard with him on a personal level, and then he backed down real quickly and agreed to let it go on the calendar. But these are things that they do to not hear bills. They can kind of either just flat out say, I'm not going to hear it, or they can kind of, you know, play some little tricks or games with the calendar, some other little tricks of the trade, so to speak, that then make it real difficult for there to be a record on some of these issues.
That's an important place, an important thing to realize. That's the music indicating the end of the first half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. We're going to ask you to stick around for the second half. Our special guest today is Representative Charles Key from the great state of Oklahoma. Stick around.
Do you need to promote your business on the internet? The Truth in Focus Radio Network reaches listeners locally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and all across the United States. The shift is on from traditional media to internet marketing. Stay on the cutting edge with your business. Advertise with us today. Email radio at truthinfocus.org. You heard the word, so will they. Email us at radio at truthinfocus.org.
Canyon State Wireless is your hands-on source for design, sales, service, and installation of the best land mobile two-way radio systems. Check us out on the web at canyonstatewireless.com or call us for specific information at 866-458-4772, 866-458-4772. Canyon State Wireless. When you're serious about communication.
And welcome back to the second half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is Amanda Teagarden in studio with James Parsons, the co-host. And our website is ok-safe.com. That's ok-safe.com. Lots of good information. We are in the midst of having, this is January 2011 broadcast, and we are in the midst of having training classes entitled Citizen Involvement in the Legislative Process. And we would like to direct your attention, if you live in the Tulsa or Broken Arrow area of Oklahoma, the northeast part of the state, that the next class will be on Saturday, January 22nd, 2011, from 9 until 12:30, and the address is located on our website. And it is important for people to exercise their civic responsibility and get engaged, understand the legislative process. These folks work for you, but only if they know who you are. And our special guest today is Representative Charles Key, who is probably known throughout the United States as the 10th Amendment man, and very well known for a lot of reasons and for a lot of different standing his ground activities. And we're very fortunate to have him as a legislator in the state of Oklahoma. He is our guest today, and we've been discussing a proposed rule change in the Oklahoma House to actually introduce a rule that says all the bills shall have a hearing and it may be voted on, but so that there is actual representation throughout the state. The other issue that Charles is known for throughout many places is the issue of nullification. And there's some confusion about what nullification is. It is not disobeying a law, but what really is it? Are you, Charles, are you back?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, let's introduce the subject of nullification. By the way, thank you for all your years of service to the state of Oklahoma as a true public servant. And actually, when I talk about the legislature, I say there are very few statesmen, but there are a few, and you are in that very short list of statesmen. And so I wanted to thank you for that, for your steadfast and honorable behavior within. I truly believe that you are trying to do what is the right thing to do. For the right reasons.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And probably the reason why a lot of his legislation doesn't get heard.
It's not politically motivated.
That's right.
All right. Nullification. What is this?
Well, nullification, it is a concept that goes back to the beginnings of our country that says that the separation of powers and the ability of the different divisions of government to determine whether or not something is constitutional or not allows, for example, a state to determine that if they believe that an act is unconstitutional, say an act of the federal legislature or even an act of the Supreme Court or an act of the executive branch, then they can choose not to allow that act to be enforced within the boundaries of their state. It's that simple. Nullify, nullification, interposition, sometimes it was referred to by Jefferson and Madison and some others, that the states themselves have a right and a responsibility even to interpose themselves between the people and the federal government whenever the federal government was enacting or trying to enact an unconstitutional action. I don't even like to call them laws anymore. I'm trying to get away from referring to laws that are unconstitutional as laws or acts that are unconstitutional as laws, because even the Supreme Court recognized this and agreed, and it's not true because the Supreme Court said it. It's true in and of itself, and they recognize this, that if an act by Congress is not constitutional, then in their words, it is no law. It is no law, because you can't have a supreme law of the land, that being the United States Constitution, and then any act of government that is in violation or contrary to the supreme law.
Can you give an example?
The lesser act has to be no law at all, and that's what the Supreme Court recognized, and that's the truth.
And that's the truth. Can you give an example of a bill or an action by the federal government that would be the prime subject of nullification?
Well, we'd have to have this show on for probably 24 hours to go through everything.
Every single one. was the bailout?
One of the most recent ones is the Obama, what's referred to as the Obamacare legislation, the two acts, laws, or there you go, the acts that were passed by Congress last year. They're unconstitutional on their face.
Were the bailouts unconstitutional?
Oh, yeah, the bailouts were one of my favorite ones. You know, after a while, it seems like, you know, you can't even remember them all. They seem to come too fast and too frequently. And, you know, the bailouts were absolutely unconstitutional. And, you know, we've come to think in this country, most people have come to believe that, I don't know about most people, quite a few people in this country, that something's only unconstitutional if the Supreme Court declares it to be unconstitutional, and that's not the case. Something is unconstitutional if it violates the Constitution, and the states play an important equal role in making that determination. And they've done this many, many, many times throughout the history of our country. They just don't teach it in our schools, and we need to start teaching this in our schools again and teach the exact times and the examples of when this was done in the history of our country. It's very important.
It is important, but I would disagree one thing is with one thing you said. It's not just in the schools, but in the Oklahoma legislature. The legislators themselves don't understand the issue of nullification. And James, you and I were at a recent Republican club dinner, and the newly appointed Republican floor leader, Dan Sullivan, and we'll say his name, Charles, you don't have to, but we will, Representative Dan Sullivan from House District 71 in the Tulsa County in Oklahoma, characterized nullification as what, how did, what example?
As an example of the school districts not, what was the law?
Applying the rule about, oh yeah, if you had a special needs child, that you could withdraw that child from public school and you would get a special account or a voucher almost to go to a place where your child's needs would be met, and the schools were not complying with it.
And he said that was an example of nullification. And it's almost in the realm of rebellion is kind of what he had kind of thought of it to be like.
And then when he was challenged on that because it was disobeying law, and a former senator was in the audience and said, your characterization of nullification is 100% in error, he backed up a little bit verbally and said, well, that was the way it was explained to me. This legislator is actually a lawyer and did not understand the true meaning of nullification. So, Charles, I mean, you're in with a body of other elected officials, many of whom themselves do not understand nullification.
Well, I would also say it may or may not be in the case of the floor leader, but oftentimes it's also an example of elitism. Those that think that we who are in charge are there to tell everyone else what to do, to put it real plainly. There are those that think that some are better equipped in various ways to make the important decisions in government, and everyone else must go along with it. And that if you are put, whether you're elected or you're appointed to some positions in government, that you're there to rule over everyone else. And none of that is true. None of that is true in regard to the system of government we have. You look at our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, and our history, and it's very clear that the founders and people throughout the history of this country have fought for just the opposite of that. The people are deemed to be equal, and they are free, and their freedoms come from God, and that government does not give any rights, and that the people are the final say on all things. Matter of fact, every constitution in the United States, that means all 50 states and the federal constitution, all includes language that says we the people are the ones that ultimately have the right to determine what is right and wrong. Now, sometimes we even maybe don't like that a little bit ourselves because we think that somehow relates to a lack of government and a lack of some type of control. But the real point is that the people that wrote the Constitution, our federal Constitution, and likewise our state constitutions, they understood that the rights come from God, and that it's the people that make that decision. It's not government that we put in charge to do certain things for us. We didn't give them the power to then determine as time goes by whether or not other important decisions, you know, could supersede that authority that comes from God and that is stated within the declarations and the constitution of the country and of the various states. So, you know, there's an elitism that's always been around since the beginning of time, and it even existed when the Constitution was first drafted and debated. You had Alexander Hamilton and a small number, a real small percentage of the founders, as we refer to them, that wanted a system that was more like the British system, or even like a monarchy. They wanted a Senate that was permanent and that was appointed by the president. They wanted governors to serve at the pleasure of the federal government or the executive branch, if I remember right how it was proposed. And it was pretty dramatic from what we ended up with. And those people have always been around and tried to get special treatment for themselves and their various special interests.
Representative Keyes, now one of the criticisms towards the 10th Amendment resolution that got passed in Oklahoma was that it was a resolution and it didn't have any teeth to it, that there wasn't really any power behind the words. And so my question to you as the author of that bill, what can we do as Oklahomans to put teeth behind that? What are we lacking to have teeth behind that? Is it just pure backbone by the legislators, or is there something that needs to be added to it to give it some type of teeth to that?
Well, it is one or two things that you just mentioned, like backbone, the legislature having the backbone. But I go back to this rule that we talked about in the first part of the program. The reason that more of this is not done and attempted and then carried out is because, on one hand, as I mentioned, you have legislators like myself that have filed state sovereignty or 10th Amendment type legislation, and then it's not even heard. Well, who's making that decision? Is it somebody that is smarter than the rest of us and that somehow they know better that we don't want to hear some of this state sovereignty legislation, or you know, what's going on there? The fact is you've got some people that don't have a backbone, or they have a political philosophy that's very much different than what most people believe, and they're making the decision for everybody else in this state. You know, and I'm not, when I say this next thing, I'm not talking about Speaker Chris Steele, the newly elected Speaker, because I have no belief that he thinks this way or will act this way. Matter of fact, far from it. But, you know, when we go to the polls every 2 years, we don't have on the ballot a Speaker of the House. The legislators decide who that Speaker is, and there's nothing in the rules that say we elect a Speaker of the House or the committee chairman or the Speaker pro tem or any of these other leadership positions to then make all the decisions for everybody else. If that were the case, then we just need to all go home and not even elect state representatives and state senators.
It becomes
we're there to make decisions.
It's a top-down model, if otherwise.
Yeah. Somebody told me a couple of weeks ago, they said, yeah, it's kind of like a Politburo. If you just have a handful of people that make all the decisions or all the important decisions. When you have just a few people that have life or death power over every bill, you know, you don't have representative republic. You don't have representative government. So back to the nullification and the 10th Amendment legislation, the reason we don't have more of it is because it's not allowed to be heard. It's squelched. This power that is assumed, it's unwritten, to have life or death power over all bills, it is not the only way that it's manifest. There's other ways that it's manifest, but it's the chief way. And if we will eliminate that, if we will prohibit that power or that action, then we'll start seeing more legislation not only filed, but what's more important, far more important than that, but we'll see it heard and then voted on, and then the people of the state can decide if they agreed with the way their state representative or state senator voted on that legislation. But see, what we can't see right now, here's something that most people in the state is interested in. They want to know if their state representative is truly for property tax reform or not. But you know what? They can't see that because just a few people have denied it to get a hearing in the legislature in an open public way and then have a recorded vote on it. If we did that, we'd find out who's really for it or not. I guarantee you that you'll see a large majority of people that are for that ad valorem reform measures, the measures that have been proposed in the House. But for some reason, they don't get a hearing. Now, something doesn't add up there. And it's the same thing with nullification legislation and many other types of legislation. Education reform bills have been put forward, and they don't get heard. We would hear a lot of things, and we'd find out how people stand on it, and then the voters of the state can then decide if their elected representatives and senators are voting and acting on their behalf in the way they want to or not.
Can you also give us kind of an example of some nullification legislation that you have tried to get heard or try to pass?
Well, there's been a, you talked about teeth, putting teeth in the 10th Amendment, and this is a proposal that I put forward actually back in 1994 or 5, and it passed the Revenue and Tax Committee that long ago when the Democrats were in the majority. They actually heard the bill and passed it out of committee and then passed it off the House floor. And it's a bill that proposes to set up a system in which the state of Oklahoma could require certain federal taxes, like federal income tax and a few others, to be paid through the state treasury, and then the state would pass it on to the federal government, the IRS.
And why would that be important?
And that's important because, you know, we have a lot of unfunded mandates, and then we have some mandates that are funded even but are unconstitutional. And it would allow the state then to have some leverage to do two things, to deny, to take action against unconstitutional legislation that is passed in the federal legislature by give us some leverage by withholding the funds related to those unconstitutional acts.
Right, because currently, wouldn't it, if we want to, let's say, nullify a certain law, the federal government still receives that money. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But under your legislation, the state would have some type of system in place in which that money can also be withheld if we feel like, let's say, Obamacare happens to be unconstitutional. Is that correct?
Yeah, and let's say they decide, well, okay, we're going to withhold money that we give you for building roads and bridges. Well, we could just withhold an equal amount of that, the same amount that would be to retain to build the roads and bridges or repair them as we need it. So it would allow us to continue to function in a constitutional manner. A lot of people listening to this are probably going to think, golly, that's kind of different. That's really maybe even radical. Well, you know, you might remember just a few years ago, people thought the 10th Amendment resolution was kind of radical. And now it's accepted as the norm.
It is the norm. And, but somebody had to start that discussion.
Yeah, and even now, this proposal that we're talking about now has been filed in quite a few other states. And we see nullification legislation like this and many others being filed all over this country. I've lost track of the numbers.
Is there any movement with that legislation that you've seen?
Well, you might refer. You know, we might be able to refer to the 10th Amendment Center, which is kind of a watchdog group or whatever you would call it that's monitoring all of the 10th Amendment legislation that's going on all over the country. In addition to other things that they do, I don't know if there's a movement on this particular piece of legislation, but there is the 10th Amendment movement that is alive and well and growing by leaps and bounds out there and has been the last two or three, 4 years. And this is one of the popular bills that's been taken up by other legislators.
I want to get to the subject of precincts before we come to the end of this hour, but I do want to recommend a book that I've seen other people reading, and I think you are also recommending it. It's entitled Nullification, How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century, and the author is Thomas E. Woods, Jr., and it's available online for purchase. Nullification, How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century, Thomas Woods. And he was a speaker at the Freedom Action Conference in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and you were a speaker at that conference also. Did you and Thomas Woods get to meet?
Yes, we've met several times in different conferences, and I actually got to meet him two or three years ago, I think it was, 3 or 4 years ago, and I've read a number of his books. You know, he's written quite a few books, and that book I couldn't recommend it any higher than any other book. It's a must read for anyone that has any interest in this subject and the problems that we're facing today in our country.
Well, maybe we can all pool some money together. You and I, James, can put a little kitty together. We'll buy this for Dan Sullivan and give this as his gift so he can understand and overcome his fear of the issue of nullification. On the issue of precincts, let's get to this before we conclude this great interview. A precinct is a geographical boundary within which the residents of that boundary all vote at a particular polling place. Within a House district or a Senate district are certain numbers of precincts. Those precincts are an important part of the political process to understand. And it may be a word or a description that you're not familiar with, but in the state of Oklahoma, and then we're talking just GOP, the Democrats are having the same thing, so whichever party you belong to, this, you be aware of this. Statewide for the GOP on Tuesday, February 1st, 2011, the statewide Republican Party precinct meetings or elections or caucuses, as sometimes as they're referred to, are taking place from 7 to 8 p.m. that night. How important is it for people to participate in their precinct elections, and they actually are going to be electing committees within the precinct, your neighbors? How important is this for the future control of a political party?
It's extremely important. I don't know how to really quantify it except to say that if you believe in a constitutional republic, if you want to have freedom, then you need to participate. You need to participate at this level and in this particular way, because it is the way in which you will influence the party and the parties, no matter what your party is, and you'll be able to tell your party and those that get elected as members of your party to legislature and all the other positions in government what you want them to, what kind of policy you want them to pursue and enact. And so it's extremely important. And, you know, people think, you know, my one vote, my one phone call, or my one letter doesn't make any difference. But that's not true. I can tell people after serving a full 16 years in the legislature and being involved in politics for 20-something years that one, two, three, four phone calls or letters or emails makes a huge difference, because we usually get zero. And so if you will show up at precinct meetings and even take that next step and go to a county convention, you have a tremendous amount of power and a large voice.
What I think people don't understand at the beginning, and I didn't understand it, is that there are two kinds of elections. There's the general election that registered voters are all, it's open to all the registered voters, whether Republican or Democrat. You participate in a primary and you go and elect a candidate for your House rep, your senator, or an issue, a question, a state question. You go to an election. That's one kind of elections. There's another set, and it's within your party. You actually have party elections, and you can elect the representatives within your party, these committees. Ultimately, if you want to control who gets on the ballot in the state of Oklahoma as a presidential candidate, it starts by participating in your precinct election on February 1st, 2011. You become a delegate. A delegate is somebody who's a member of that district. You just have to be a registered voter of that party. Then you get to be a delegate to your, as you mentioned, your county convention. There's 77 counties. There'll be 77 county conventions. At that convention, there will be a sign-up sheet or participation in the state convention. You then become a delegate to the state convention, which is the following month. Those delegates at that state convention get to vote on the rules, the state party platform, which is the statement of what the Republican Party believes. And then you also get to sign up to be the delegates to the Republican National Convention, which will be held in some other city. Well, 2 years ago, it was held in Minnesota. There's a process that these delegates go through to be chosen, because each state gets a certain number of delegates. Our state got 37 delegates. Some of them are elected and some of them are just a natural, and you get to be part out of that. You get to be part of the Electoral College. The Electoral College is the one that actually elects the president. So How does that start? That starts at your precinct level. This is, if we can just help the public get over the mystery of what this process is, if this is all too complicated, just go to your precinct meeting and do that part and then learn how to do the next part. I mean,
well, I think it's also, I was going to say, it's also important people know, if they haven't ever done anything like this before or don't know how it works, you don't have to give a speech. You don't have to say anything publicly. You don't have to worry about being put on the spot or anything, because none of that's going to happen. You'll be able to vote, just like you said, Amanda. You'll be able to vote on all of those things and have a tremendous impact in the system, in the process.
And it's so few people who participate. If it's you and your husband or you and your wife or you and your neighbor, whoever it is, and that's all who shows up at these precinct meetings, you can have a proper election of I vote for you and you vote for me. Done, do the paperwork, turn it in, and then go to the county convention. And it's not, I can relate to the intimidation factor of because I had not myself had never done this, but once you do it once, you're like, this was a whole lot easier than I thought. The advantage of being an elected committee person or chairman in your precinct is then you get access to what's called Voter Vault. And you get to find all the other people in your precinct who are part of your party or the other ones also. And then you have access to the other people who vote. And guess what? Your value to your elected official just went up, because all of a sudden they know that you know the people that elected them. And you'll have access to the rankings of those people, whether they're a frequent voter or an infrequent voter. And then the political reality is those who are frequent voters have greater worth to a politician who's concerned about re-election than the guy that never votes. That's a reality. So it's worthwhile.
It is reality.
It is reality. It shouldn't be, because once they're elected, they represent everybody. But we've received too many push cards and participated in too many campaigns. And I think, James, you saw this,
right,
that some people are worth more to a legislator, a potential candidate, than others.
Well, I get, when I talk to people who think about getting into the political process, they have this idea, because I had it too, that there's just thousands of people involved in the whole process. But then once you get into it, you realize, my goodness, the room is so small. It's probably just a couple of hundred people, and you can change a precinct or a county or a state with just a few people. Some people think, man, you must have an army of 10,000 to be able to change policy and to change a state. And really, you don't. You just need a few dedicated women and men that are willing to take up a little bit of time. And you can change the course of where you live by just being involved.
It's possible and it's doable. We're down to about a minute and a half. Charles, is there anything that you would just want to end with in closing on this subject and others?
Yeah, you know, on this subject, we used to, in this state, conduct our presidential preference system. I don't want to say primary, but we would choose our presidential candidates by the caucus system, and that means it starts at the precinct level and the decisions are made at the precinct level as they go up through the various steps, the county, the congressional district, and the state, and the delegates would be elected to the individual on behalf of the individual presidential candidates. And then we changed to a strict primary system that we go to the polls and elect or just to cast a vote for those presidential candidates that we want to vote for. And the caucus system is much more efficient, but it's also much more important. It carries a lot more weight. And there's a lot of interest in going back to that system. And I actually filed a bill in the past. I refiled it again this year, just about a week ago, to require that the primary elections paid for by the individual parties, and that we go back to the caucus system. It costs quite a bit of money to conduct a primary.
Yes. And that's our music, Charles, and we're going to have you back again to discuss that again, and we're going to be drumming up support for that particular piece of legislation. We thank you for being our guest today on America in the Balance. That's the end of our program for today, and we thank you once again for listening.